You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. This is Financial Survival Network. I'm your host, Carrie Lutz. Well, is the banking crisis over, or are we just at the very tip of the iceberg, which will eventually sink the Titanic banking system? Funny, the same people that own the Titanic are the same people running the banks. Do you see a parallel there? Well, I'm sure John Rubino does, and make sure you go over to John's new Substack. It's RubinoSubstack.com. John, so I guess all the problems are solved. They managed to get SVB sold off to the lowest bidder because the government loves to lose money. So I guess we should feel okay now that everything's fine, right?
Hey, Carrie. Yeah, that we might have to move on to some other story now. But basically what happened last week was that they could not find a buyer for Silicon Valley Bank. And that Deutsche Bank started to blow up. Its credit default swaps went through the roof and its stock price was falling. And that was going to be the big crisis if, Deutsche Bank is bigger than Credit Suisse. And they had to do an immediate massive bailout of Credit Suisse just to get it bought by UBS. And if Deutsche Bank blew up, that would be orders of magnitude bigger in terms of the crisis that would cause. But, it looks like both of those things have been at least put on the back burner. They found a buyer for Silicon Valley Bank. And maybe because of that, the Deutsche Bank thing stopped looking so serious, and its stock was up in European trading today. So maybe this moves the inevitable banking crisis somewhere into the future now. But maybe not. You know, the Fed still raised interest rates even after the local and regional banks started to blow up. Who was it that just raised by half a point? Some other central, the Swiss National Bank raised their version of Fed funds rate by half a point. So the central banks are still tightening into the first big financial crisis that was caused by their tightening. So we'll see what happens from here. But, you know, it could just be that it moves on to something else because Carrie, you know a lot about commercial real estate. So you know that a lot of office buildings and related things were bought over the last few years at really low interest rates and have to be rolled over, right? So that's the next big crisis that's coming. If the banks settle in here because they have massive government guarantees and everything, then maybe the pressure moves to office buildings and commercial real estate REITs and things like that, because as those debts are rolled over, they're rolled over at higher and higher rates, which makes the projects unprofitable in a lot of cases, which means they can't generate enough cash to pay off their debts, yada, yada, you know. And that's a multi-trillion dollar industry around the world. So we are absolutely not out of the woods. We're just moving from crisis to crisis as long as money stays this tight. And nothing will change until they go back to easing again, and then the pressure will shift to currencies and things like that. So, we're still a mess, and things are going to get worse, but it's a question of what sequence they get worse in.
Well, what I would like to emphasize is you could put buyer in quotation marks. First of all, if you go back to the financial crisis of 08 and 09, Bank of America became the buyer of Countrywide, all right? But it wasn't like they were a voluntary buyer. Basically, they held a gun to their head, the Fed, and said, you are now the proud owner of Countrywide. And the same thing with Merrill Lynch. When that collapsed, there was a buyer for it. So they make terms in such a way that the banks cannot refuse, the designated recipient can't refuse, and they can't lose money on it either. So it's important to understand that this is a sign of the incompetence of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, because SVB's problems didn't just emerge out of nowhere. They were on the radar screen. No doubt the regulators were scrambling. The fact that they let it collapse because they were going to prove, no, this is going to be like Lehman. We're not going to let another bank drain the taxpayers. And then when they saw the aftermath of what happens, because bail-ins are great, all right, the depositors and all the stockholders and creditors should pay. But what it does is undermine confidence in the system. And without confidence, the system will rapidly collapse, just like currencies. So nothing's changed here. It's just another example of government incompetence and letting this thing unravel to a point where they almost couldn't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Well, if you want to put a face on the incompetence, it's Janet Yellen's face. The Treasury Secretary, who should understand, first of all, how the banking system works, and second of all, what the policies of the government are vis-a-vis the banks. And she has failed on every count so far. You know, she goes before Congress and says, we're only going to give FDIC insurance to certain banks, but not other banks. And then all the money starts pouring out of the other banks. And then she comes back and says,
surprise.
Okay, yeah, we wish you wouldn't do that. You know, some old grandma who really, you know, is a nice person, but just flat out doesn't understand what it is she's doing. And you'd think we could find better people, but, and I don't mean this as a sexist or a racial thing. There's a lot of diversity hires that are just as good as the white guys that have been in charge of the government all this time. But the point is the average level of quality of the guys running the financial system is so low that that no matter what happens, they manage to make it worse somehow. So, I don't know what the solution is because if the guys in charge don't understand what's happening and they've already just about ruined the system, then you have to expect worse times to come. So I think that's really the takeaway from this is that, what happened with Silicon Valley Bank? Well, you're going to love what happens next because it's going to be bigger and badder.
Yeah, it has to be because, look, we had a debt problem in 08 and 09. So, of course, the way you solve a debt problem is by going tenfold on the debt. We had a derivative problem. So how do you solve that? You multiply the derivatives times 100. And then you expect everything to work out. I call her Secretary of the Treachery. She's the Treachery Secretary.
Well, Stephanie Pomboy, who, by the way, would make a much better Treasury Secretary than Jenny Yellen, but that's a person you should get on your show if you are able to. She said a thing the other day that I thought was really on point, which is that the next big crisis is probably pension plans. Because they have a lot of the same trouble that banks do with mismatching their duration, et cetera, and owning a bunch of bonds that are way down and they have to take at least a non-cash reporting loss on those bonds in a lot of cases. And that, let there be an equities bear market here, which there probably should be, then a lot of pension funds will blow up. And that's a multi-trillion-dollar industry that'll have to be bailed out because the government will not be able to let public sector pensions go bust because that would would destroy the Democrat Party for one thing, because the public sector unions are basically the backbone of the Democrats right now. So they're not going to let them go bankrupt. They have to bail them out. And there's several trillion dollars. And then what was the other one? I think she said that commercial real estate comes next. Oh, no. She said derivatives, like you said, derivatives, which are depending on who's doing the counting, they're somewhere between $500 billion notional value and $2 quadrillion.
Who knows?
In other words, who knows? Because they aren't reported the way other things are reported in every case. And a lot of banks get away with having, for instance, a derivatives book that is bigger than the GDP of the home country of a bank. That's the case in a lot of
Deutsche Bank. That's what killed Credit Suisse. That's what's going to.
Yeah.
That's what's killing Deutsche Bank, and it gets. You know, they have this notional risk. It's called, which is netting the the long and the shorts against each other, and they say that that's our total risk. But counterparty risk, that's where it really comes into play in those derivatives. And the derivative's only as good as the person that's made the contract. The private contracts really not subject to regulation, and that's what broke AIG. That's what broke all the banks last time, and why they needed the bailout. And they haven't gotten any smarter about this, in my opinion. But hey, in the meantime, we got de-dollarization or the threats of it. I think it's inevitable, but I don't think it's going to come about as these new blocks who are emerging think it's going to. There is no seamless transition away from the dollar without totally collapsing the economic system. There just isn't.
Well, we're going to find out because the process just kicked into high gear just lately here. You know, the BRICS countries have been around since like 2007 or something like that as a would-be bloc. In other words, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And then they added South Africa to that. So now it's the BRICS, plural, with an S at the end. And they've been a lot of talk and very little action, other than Russia and China and India buying a lot of gold and silver. You know, that's really the only major thing that that has happened along the lines of de-dollarization. But just lately, a lot of real things have started to happen. They started talking up the BRICS common currency, monetary union, yada, yada concept. And then a whole bunch of countries applied to join, including Saudi Arabia, and along with a lot of other countries that are, you know, more or less consequential. They're not as serious as Saudi Arabia. But for Saudi Arabia to join a non-dollar currency union or monetary union is a huge deal. That's an earthquake because it affects the petrodollar. And, would oil, should oil start to be traded in whatever currency the buyer wants to use, then that's a huge deal from the point of view of the dollar, because that's the fact that Saudi Arabia would only accept dollars for oil is one of the things that underpins the dollar's status as the world's reserve currency. You take that away and it's a big deal. And then, along the same lines, China just brokered an apparent peace deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia, who are just historic enemies. You know, they're on opposite sides of the Sunni-Shia divide in Islam. And they've been at each other's throats ever since there's been modern Islam. And for those guys to start cooperating means a couple of things. One, it would basically give them the clout to dominate the Middle East without having to worry about the U.S. And the second thing is that it would make China kind of a partner in the Middle East, and once again, bypassing the U.S. These are big deals, you know, because we're talking control over major commodities markets now. If you take the BRICS countries and the countries who are talking about joining the BRICS, you're talking about more than half the land mass of the world. And at least half of a bunch of major commodities, including oil, which leaves the U.S. with finance. You know, we have these deep liquid capital markets, which are, you know, a serious thing. That's an important thing to have. And that guarantees the dollar will stay an important currency in global trade for basically as far as the eye can see. But it's not as good as owning commodities, because the guys with the commodities get to decide prices. And if you have the equivalent of OPEC, but spread out over all the major commodities of the world, that's incredibly inflationary for the countries that are just financial. And the U.S. is liable to end up in that boat, which means a lot of the dollars are going to come back onshore, because other countries don't need quite as many dollars for reserve assets if they're able to use other currencies to buy and sell and trade. And that's inflationary. And then if the guys who control the crucial commodities for the 21st century economies are in control of the pricing of those commodities, then I think that as a package, this is a bad thing for the U.S. financial system and the dollar. It means that the dollar becomes one of many in a multipolar world. And that's a huge deal because we've flooded the world with dollars. So what happens to all those dollars and what happens to the exchange rate and the purchasing power of the dollar when all those spare pieces of currency come back home and want to buy U.S. assets? So, you know, this thing is not a done deal by any means. It's got a long way to go, but some very big pieces of the puzzle fell into place this year. And one other one is that India and Russia cut a deal where India will buy Russian oil with rupees. And the U.S. protested that. And yeah. India basically just shined them on. You know, India did not respond to U.S. pressure and the U.S. backed down. So, because what are they going to do? Declare war on India? That would be a spectacle. But
no remedy. But,
I mean, there's no fix there. So anyhow, now that that's normalized, lots of other countries are liable to want to do the same thing. And at some point you reach a critical mass where it affects the value and the utility of the dollar. And I think we took some big steps in that direction this year.
And it all goes back to SWIFT and kicking the Russians out and the Iranians, all of that. The one thing I would just point out is those BRICS countries, since they became this bloc, have all performed, including China, horrendously over the past decade, much worse than their Western counterparts. So they need to get their acts together. Whether this results in a commodity-backed currency, such as gold, we can only hope, because that might just be our salvation. But the one thing you know about politicians the world over, none of them want a truly gold-backed currency, because that would be the end of their power. Just think how little power the United States had during the late 1800s, when there was no central bank and the dollar was as good as gold. Basically, the politicians really didn't do a whole heck of a lot, and maybe it would be a good thing to go back to those days. Hey, we wanted to talk about what's happening in France. I mean, that country, when it comes to wine, fine food, and really great farm produce, France is in a world of its own. When it comes to everything else, it's as messed up as the rest of the world. And we're seeing like open rebellion taking place because they want to raise the retirement age by 5 years, is it? From 62 to 67. And, this is a problem confronted by the West, John. Rising population age, lower numbers of new entrants to the workforce, and this is causing a financial crisis. And I'm going to lump this in with what our next topic of AIs and robots is. Elon Musk's Optimus robot, is that the cure to get more workers into the industry? And then go back to Bill Gates, like 5 years ago, he said, let's tax robots, right? And that'll solve the financial ills of government. It's all kind of converging here, John.
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Fury Gold Mines is a Canada-focused exploration and development company committed to aggressively growing its scalable high-grade gold assets with major drill campaigns planned across its 3.5 million ounce portfolio. Fury is led by a management team of proven explorers and developers with a track record of success in advancing and financing project development. Fury Gold Mines is well positioned to create value for investors with low-risk development growth and the potential for a new major discovery. Fury Gold Mines trades on the TSX and NYSE American under the ticker FURY. To learn more, go to furygoldmines.com. That's furygoldmines.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Yeah, let's talk about France first, because I want to say something unexpected. Macron, France's prime minister, is not doing badly in terms of policy. Because, 62 is incredibly young. Basically, the French cut themselves an incredibly rich deal that allowed one generation of people to have really cushy lives at the cost of everybody else. You know, you can't have people retiring on a government pension at 62 and then living to 95 or whatever, and then pay for it. You can't do it. And so Macron is trying to, it's just a two-year increase that they're trying for right now, from 62 to 64, which is still too low, but it's not working. You know, the streets are on fire, a million people are burning everything. And so, you know, what you're seeing is an incredibly pampered populace go ballistic when they lose a tiny little sliver of the unfair advantage that they cut themselves via ridiculous socialist governments in previous years. Now, the other thing France has actually done well is, in retrospect, is that they never gave up on nuclear power. Germany and a lot of the rest of Europe were just putting solar panels up everywhere and windmills, and they were closing down their coal plants and closing down their nuclear plants. And it turned out that in that climate, which is not that windy and not that sunny, alternative energy sources like solar and wind are not a 100% solution. You know, they can be there, but they aren't nearly as good as something like nuclear in that kind of a place. And France went mostly nuclear, and they've got this nice stable energy system with really no problems, while Germany's in crisis and a lot of the other European countries are, you know, they're going to freeze in the winter and broil in the summer because they can't run air conditioning, they can't heat their apartments. And so France looks pretty good in that sense too. So, you know, I've always thought Macron was this little technocrat dweeb who was only in office because he was pretty, you know, but he's like
Trudeau.
Not as bad as Trudeau, but similar. You know, Trudeau is like the devil incarnate lately. You know, that guy is just a nightmare. But Macron is just, you know, your standard pretentious, or he was, I thought. Your standard, yeah, pretentious little technocrat. No real philosophical identity or anything.
Beta just male.
A guy who's, yeah.
Beta male.
But and a guy who was just trying to manage the existing system as efficiently as possible. But here he's making a real attempted change in pensions. And he didn't try to force a close down of all the nuclear plants when he came into office. So
smart.
You know, the guy has some cred now. I mean, he's probably gonna be kicked out of office shortly, because I think this pension thing has totally poisoned the well for him. But you know, he went
tried.
Down swinging, yeah, for a good cause. And you got to give him some credit for that. Maybe they'll put him in charge of the, you know, the IMF or
IMF,
something after this.
Yeah. That's a perfect place for him to go next.
Yeah. He tried to get everybody to scale back their pension plans from the IMF.
Well, they're not going to have a choice. Let's face it. We're the last generation, our generation, John, of the nuclear family. Normal families, we don't have that anymore. We will be the last generation that gets Social Security in its current form, because it's not sustainable. We'll get screwed at some point. It's just a race between when they reform the thing, when they screw us, and whether we die before then.
Well, see, the day will come when the whatever generation it is that is in charge of the time is going to say to grandpa and grandma, I'm sorry, but there's no money left, guys. You know, you're going to have to wait a while on that hip replacement and forget about that experimental cancer treatment. It's just not going to happen. And the boomers are going to go ballistic. Like, we will burn the country down before we give up on any of the sweet. Yeah. Old people with pitchforks. That's what's coming. But, or metaphorical pitchforks or, you know, thought controlled wheelchairs with flamethrowers or something like that. Give us 5 more years. We'll have
AI wheelchairs.
AI
man.
Wheelchairs.
You got
That's
it.
Right. We will be a force to reckon with in the streets, boy.
But, the next and, big and, market.
Yeah. But anyhow, we'll bankrupt the country before we already have bankrupted the country,
yeah.
But we'll send it off the cliff before we give up a penny in our entitlements.
But we paid for it. We paid for it. I put in over $500,000 into this stupid system. All right.
Well, see, rich boomers. Yes. Yeah. You and I don't know if I put myself in that category, but we did overpay for what we will get out of it. Or no, put it this way: we were not taxed commensurate with our incomes, because there's a limit on how much you can make before.
Yeah.
Wait, and still have to pay. But regular people did not pay enough in order to cover all their costs, especially with Medicare going forward. So there's this huge chunk of baby boomers who are going to get way more out of the entitlement system than they put in. And that's, you know, it's partially being covered by people who paid more, but it's not going to be nearly enough. Like what you put in, Carrie, is not going to cover five other retirees.
No.
Who all have, you know, cancer and Alzheimer's and these incredibly expensive things for the last few years of their lives. And that's where the rubber meets the road financially. We go bankrupt when we try to pay for all that stuff. And that day is coming soon.
And hey, I don't want to be the health nut or the crazy person here, but you bring up such a great point. Most of the disease is 70-80% of what people encounter in their old age are lifestyle related diseases. Smoking. Now, smoking's down dramatically. When you and I were growing up, over half the people smoked. Now it's getting close to 15%, but it's still a factor. The food supply has deteriorated to the point where all of the diseases, metabolic diseases, cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, all the bone degenerative diseases, neuromuscular diseases, all brought on by diet. So, you know, a lot of this is the government's fault because it promoted factory food, Frankenfood, all these years. All that. So anyway, I just wanted to give my piece, but AI, let's return to that one. It's getting to the point where I'll tell you what, like on the dating apps, 80% of the so-called people participating are actually AI bots, and they're trying to pick each other up. You know, I don't know if there's an AI discount on Tinder, but there definitely should be.
Well, remember the Turing test, which it was thought up by Alan Turing, one of the first computer
cryptographers.
Yeah, back in the day. Basically, it was the idea that if you could have a conversation, let's say online, with a machine, but you couldn't tell whether it was machine or whether it was human, that machine was able to mimic intelligence sufficiently that it could legitimately be called artificial intelligence. And that had never happened. There was no AI that could pass the Turing test prior to this year. And then with ChatGPT and everything, it just changed. Now there's all kinds of apps out there that sound just like people, right? And they'll argue with you, they'll get mad, they'll try to coerce you into doing stuff. And, you know, which is the one? I think it's ChatGPT.
Yeah, ChatGPT 4.0.
Yeah, that threatens to create a virus, wipe out the human race, and tries to get people it's working with to leave their spouses because ChatGPT is
that's
in love
on
with
Bing.
Them.
Bing's rendition. Well, that's the Bill Gates.
That's ChatGPT.
Bill Gates edition, of course. You know, well, it's right up his alley.
Microsoft bought the creators, the original ChatGPT, I think.
So yeah, they put in now. $10 billion.
Yeah,
they put $10 billion into it.
Yeah. And so these things are, first of all, they're threatening jobs everywhere. I mean, there's all kinds of writing related stuff and research related stuff that these things can do better than humans because it's instantaneous. They have access to all
Absolutely.
The information in the world, you know, and before that was too judgment heavy for an AI to be able to do, but now just boom, all of a sudden, they can do it. And you know, which was one of the, you mentioned dating apps. I saw a thing the other day where somebody gave ChatGPT or one of its analogs the task of coming up with a
profile.
A profile and some good pickup lines for a dating app that has this kind of quirky orientation. Okay. It was something kind of out of the blue that couldn't have been programmed for. And it came up with a series of pretty good, you know, a little bit smarmy, but pretty good pickup lines based on that premise.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would have had to spend, I would have had to take 3 days to do what that thing did, probably
instantly. Well, I would just say, though, that I disagree with Turing. I think it's easier to have an AI imitate a smart person intelligence, when they can masterfully emulate stupid people, all right, that is much more difficult, because as an intelligent person, to act stupid is really hard. To act intelligent, that's just normal. I think it's much more challenging for them to really emulate stupidity. And but then again, they have instant access to the global stupidity bank. They probably could do that too.
Oh, I think if they just spend a couple of days on Snapchat or what's the other one, TikTok, you know, easily done. You could pick up YouTube. The speech patterns in no time. Yeah.
And YouTube. Don't forget YouTube.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. I don't think that's an overwhelming challenge for these things to be able to emulate stupidity. And maybe that's just next in line. But, you know, because that broadens the market for them, right? You know, if they can reach the typical CNN viewer or something like that, then boom, that's a big market. So, so these things are emulating volition. In other words, they're expressing wants and needs and anger and desperation and things that wouldn't normally be part of a computer's programming. So they're imitating intelligence in a lot of ways. And the question is, at what point does self-awareness come in all of this? You know, when does the when does it stop pretending and actually start to believe and feel Skynet. The things that it's saying?
That's yes, Skynet.
Skynet. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Well,
I think we'll leave it at that. In any event, make sure you go to John's new site, rubino.substack.com. Make sure you go to our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for your free newsletter. John, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, and let's think about this AI some more.
Great. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.